Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be at the Masonic Temple for another DEC event. Today, Austin Goolsbee from the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank is our guest of honor and will be speaking to the audience very soon. Our first guest this afternoon is Nicole Sherrard Freeman. She is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Community Foundation of Southeastern Michigan. Such a great organization, Nicole. Since 1984, the $1.5 billion of investment that's gone into the people, the communities, the organizations to help this region, covering seven counties, Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Monroe, Washtenaw, Livingston, and St. Clair. So we're really pleased to have you join the show today.
So excited to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
So you're relatively new as the CEO of the organization. I think you started in January of 2025. This is one of the largest community foundations in the country. Why don't you give the audience a sense of the vision that you have for the foundation's role in the region? And what were your observations about 2025?
Yeah, what an exciting question. And there is so much, I can't go on without saying how much energy there is in the room. I think we've got a room full of folks excited to see Austin Goolsbee today. So this is the thing about community foundations, right? Like, we are uniquely positioned in community to take in assets and also make grants. And that's the thing that's different between a community foundation and a private foundation. So we are thought leaders, we like to believe. We are partners, we are conveners, we bring together community and those who are interested in making a charitable impact or having philanthropic impact on community together to talk about issues that matter to the region. As you said, we cover seven counties, 4.2 million residents. And I got to tell you, we spent a lot of time in 2025 getting our donors and our partners and our nonprofit friends closer to the work, right? Like, get them in to understand how all the important pieces in Southeast Michigan fit together to build thriving communities for everyone. And our donors and our partners are telling us we're headed in the right direction.
You have a unique career background. So you were in the corporate sector, you managed your own business as an entrepreneur, you've had nonprofit experience, you worked in the Doug administration, leading workforce development, and now you're sitting on the philanthropy side deploying necessary capital to benefit organizations and people throughout the region. So it's such a wide variety of experiences. What might some people be missing about Detroit and southeastern Michigan that you want to share?
Yeah, so I appreciate the question. I believe that when you talk to leaders across all the sectors that I've been privileged to work in and those that I haven't been in, right? Like, I haven't been in higher ed, for example. When you talk to leaders in those sectors individually, everybody says one thing, right? Like, it's important for us to work together to solve the challenges that are facing the region. But when you move that down to ground level, when you're at ground zero and you're operationalizing, we tend to stay in our silos. And it isn't intentional. It's a function of having so much to do with so few resources in so little time. And so people just get laser focused on what's in their lane. And what we sometimes miss is the opportunity to pull up and think regionally, think about where our lanes cross and should cross and where we're duplicative. There's so much opportunity at this moment in particular to be more deliberate and intentional about our partnerships.
Sounds like a lot of collaboration opportunity as well.
That's
as
right.
As you look through even the nonprofit sector, the business sector, and how these things really come together.
That's right.
There's not a shortage of dynamics that are disrupting our local and national economy these days. So what impact will that have on the foundation, and how are you thinking about the foundation's future role within our area?
Yeah. One thing that we're excited about, and our donors and partners say the same, is regionalism. And I'm not suggesting that there is a shared, common, simple definition of regionalism, but I am suggesting what you just named, which is that collaborating, intentional collaboration, intentional discussion of hard topics and tough issues that are affecting the residents of the seven-county region we're responsible for, and more broadly, the state. Talking about those hard topics on purpose is the way we'll find solutions that work for everyone. And so in 2026 and beyond, we're just hyped about being conveners of those conversations, whether we're able to you know, write checks or support financially or not is a separate topic. But being a trusted partner, being a place that the community and leaders in the region can count on to spark those conversations, hold those conversations, and keep things moving forward, that's one role, important role and way that we see ourselves.
So you had the opportunity to join a panel discussion back in 2023 with Austin Gouldsby, who's our speaker today at the Detroit Economic Club. The topic of youth employment in a post-COVID economy was part of the discussion. What are you expecting to hear from Austin's remarks today at our event?
Yeah, I'm excited to hear him again. I got to tell you, being on a panel with him was so much fun. I mean, and I mean this with all due respect and great fondness for economists. They're not always the most accessible, fun people to be around. Austin is the exception to that. So I'm just really excited to hear him talk about in an environment that is far more complex than many of us have seen, how should we be interpreting key indicators that we've come to rely on over the past, decades. What indicators should we be looking for now? How do we measure for ourselves what's stable and what is becoming unstable? Our access to data and the type of data that we can analyze grows exponentially more sophisticated every day. How do we make sense of it? How do we make sense of our economy in our new context?
Well, and we find in the financial services industry that there's such a tight correlation between how the economy is doing and how the businesses and consumers that we support at the credit union are able to thrive or not. And I would venture to say that there's a lot of connectivity in your foundation with the health of the economy and the things that people are experiencing.
That's right.
If people want to get involved, whether it's a business or a consumer, what are some ways that you would suggest that they engage with the Community Foundation?
Well, the first way would be to reach out and we can help you decide whether you're interested in being a one-time donor to a cause that you care about, or whether you're interested in a broader conversation about what's really going on in the region. So go to our website. It's communityfoundationforsoutheastmichigan.org, cfsem.org, or call us at 961-6675.
That's great. Well, we enjoyed having you on the show. This is Nicole Sherrard Freeman, the president and CEO of the Community Foundation of Southeastern Michigan. Thanks for taking some time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're happy to be back at the Masonic Temple. I'm joined by our friend Tony Michaels, president and CEO of the Parade Company. Tony, welcome.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
So let's talk about the Heart of History campaign, which is focusing on the fundraising for the new Parade Company headquarters and the Parade Studio right on Detroit's waterfront. With a connection point to the Riverwalk. So what's the latest? What updates would you want to share, Tony?
Well, it's been a long ride, but we're persevering, as people know. I mean, we started this 7-8 years ago, and we are at about $11 million right now, but there's a key moment right now where we now have Republican and Democratic sponsorship on our bill for $10 million for the budget coming up May, June, when they dive into it. Cross your fingers. Please, when you're out there with Michigan politicians, tell them how important this is to our community and how we're going to clean up blight. We're going to do things for kids, families, literally create something phenomenal for our city and our state.
The renderings of the buildings look terrific. And, it's when we see that come to fruition, it's going to be a win not only for you and your leadership, but all the community partners that are helping support it. So can't happen soon enough.
Well, thank you. We put a lot of work into that. We worked with Rossetti and Matt Rossetti and his team years ago. And it took us 5 years to get through the Detroit Historical Commission because that building's historic. And we met all the requirements and they gave us the progress. Now we have to raise the money and let's get this done. It'll be a game changer.
And it looks like they're doing a great job with some of the preservation. You can see that in the presentations that are out there, and using some of the historic elements, it's really gonna come together nicely. So June 22nd, we've got the fireworks that are sponsored by Ford. It's kind of what I would say the Detroit summer kickoff at the Center Garage roof. your big annual fundraiser. DFCU Financial bought our table. We just got our confirmation.
My so hero. We're
glad to be there.
Thank
so
you. Thank you.
Talk about how you take an event that is historically voted as one of the top in the country, and you keep it fresh. What would people think about it in terms of their expectation?
Well, we strive to make it the number one show in America, and it's been rated that steadily. We have Zambelli, who actually does the fireworks. I do the music. We choreograph with Patrick Barreau, who's with Zambelli, and we really set the show up in the right way. And it's 24 minutes, but that's not what signifies it as the biggest. It's what we put in those 24 minutes. If people out there have seen it, it is out of control. We jam it. We make it crazy. Probably four different times you think it's over, and it's not. And get ready. The music track this year is really cool. And Zambelli, Patrick Barreau, we're on the edge right now, finalizing the choreography. And June 22nd, if you haven't bought your table, Ryan, thank you. We have some left, but they go fast. We send out the original letter, and then the invitations are yet to even go out, and we're almost sold out. So,
well, I wanted to make sure we didn't miss it. I mean, I carried ours right down to the post office myself. So talk a little bit about what's following. So we've got the 100-year anniversary of the America's Thanksgiving Parade that's presented by Gardner White. Mm-hmm. So what would be in store for a 100-year celebration? And maybe talk about how the partnership with Gardner White came to be.
Well, I'll tell you, Gardner White, and I was just with Rachel sitting down, and Rachel Stewart, and it is phenomenal. They are our presenting sponsor through 2031, which is just amazing. What great partners. Rachel and her team, they get it. They really do. And, yeah, this is the 100th year. So think about it. How many things in this country have really stuck around for 100 years. So here's the parade presented by Gardner White. Not only 100 years, but growing like crazy. Sponsorship up to a level where it's never been before. People showing up. The floats, we took them from 40 feet to 120 feet. Everything is bigger, better, and bolder. But there's some surprises coming this year. I can't tell you yet. We've already talked to the Grand Marshal. We're going to announce that after the Ford fireworks, later in June, early July. And then you're going to see some special guests here in Detroit that you may have recognized from Detroit, you know, and make them a part of this. And this is a really special moment because it is the heart and soul of our city and state, the largest event.
I don't think people fully appreciate all the prep work that needs to go into, whether it's the fireworks celebration in June or the Thanksgiving-related events, the parade, the turkey trot. Give people a little bit of a behind-the-scenes look at what needs to happen to pull that off to make such a terrific impression on those that you're impacting.
Well, it's massive. It really is. In fact, the parade, we start the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, and our team of 20, we sit in a room and we go through everything. How can we make it better next year? And we instantly start locking up the contracts, starting the design work. These floats take 3 months to build. The contracts are 3 years. So this year we're building 8 brand new floats. So we have 5 returning companies and 3 brand new companies who've never been with us before. So it is a process to get to the design, the build. And we're doing all of that while we're setting up everything else. And then the Ford fireworks, the S3 Turkey Trot. We're going to be making an announcement on that April 27th with Cindy Paskey, the owner and CEO of S3. There's just a lot happening, but it doesn't stop. But I have to tell you, all of my friends say, geez, how does it feel to work 4 days a year?
Well, that's why I asked you that question. So you can you have a counterpoint now to the people asking you in that way. So such a great opportunity to have you on today, Tony, and you're doing such great work at the parade company. We're looking forward to the June event, the Ford fireworks, and then the way the year's sailing by, the Thanksgiving-related events are going to be right behind us. So, you know, thank you for your leadership and what you do, and always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you. I have greatest team in the world. We really do. They're great people. Thank you.
Tony Michaels, President and CEO of the Parade Company. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm pleased pleased to be joined by Anthony Bellino, our co-host of Sports Wrap with Lomas Brown and Anthony Bellino, which runs weeknights at 6 o'clock on WJR. So, Anthony, thanks for being with us.
Ryan, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We've got a lot of sports to talk about. I don't think we would start with anything other than the Michigan Wolverines, the national champions for NCAA basketball. So give us your sense of how you saw the evolution of the team over the course of the year and then through the tournament.
You know, it's really interesting, and you know, I saw this very early on because, you know, so much has been made of the transfer portal, and I tried to tell Lomas this, that this was going to be a special group, and the reason I thought that was is because with so many new faces, this group of guys came together and they played a brand of basketball that anybody, that whether you were a parent of a fifth grade team or a coach of a youth basketball team at any level, you could watch this team and you could take a lot from them, meaning that they were willing to turn down good shots in order to get great shots. They didn't care who got the credit on any given night. All they cared about was it was we over me all the time, and it was about winning as a team. And that's why they set a program record with 37 wins this year. That's why they were able to win the national championship this year. That's why even, you know, last night when things went awry, I mean, they played probably one of the worst games that they have played in a while. I mean, it looked like somebody put a toilet seat over top the rim, for God's sakes. I mean, nothing would go in. The heck with the Saran wrap. It was like a lid was on that hoop. And they still found a way to win and come up in big-time clutch moments. And it's a team that I think that all Michigan fans can be very, very proud of, just the style in which they play. And, of course, the head coach, Dusty May, the job that he did in getting so many different pieces from all over the country to come together and to be able to buy in so quickly to this idea that we have to be greater than the sum of our parts, that type of thinking here. And as long as we keep the main thing the main thing, which is what our team goal is, we can be really, really successful. And with team success comes individual success. They had all the individual accolades all season long, and that's because of where they were at as a team.
So Michigan's second NCAA title for the men's program, the first one since 1989. And it comes at a perfect time with the NCAA Final Four being hosted in Detroit next year. You know, when I look back at the game last night, Anthony, Elliott Cadow, recognized as the Final Four outstanding player of the tournament. But what really resonated with me was that three-point shot he made that put them up by 11, really around the middle of the second half. That just felt like a big spark to me. What did you think?
Oh, I mean, Elliott has just been, and the best part about Elliott Cadow is the fact that, you know, he was the guy that was a castaway from North Carolina. I mean, they said that he wasn't good enough, that he couldn't shoot, and then here he is with the game high in points for the Wolverines in the biggest game of the season. I mean, that was such a dagger in that ball game to get this team to where they needed to be. And I also want to give credit to the young freshman, Trey McKinney. I mean, you talk about a young man with, you know, there's so much that goes into being a freshman at this level, right? And everybody wants the ball and everybody wants to play a ton of minutes. And here you are, you got a veteran-laden group, you got the number one player out of the portal in Yaxel Lennenborg. You bring up Elliott Cadow coming over from UNC. You got the bigs in Adaimara and Morris Johnson. You've got plenty of guard play with LJ Case, and that poor young man who blew his knee out against Illinois. You know, he was coming back for his second season. Roddy Gale and Amari Burnett, and all these different guys. And here comes Trey McKinney in the perfect example of what a freshman should be entering college basketball. Don't worry about starting every game, and don't worry about trying to score 40 points a night. Take the coaching, take the responsibility as it comes, and your opportunities will come. And between Elliott Cadow's big three and then Trey McKinney hitting a dagger there on the right wing, I mean, those two shots right there, the only two threes we hit all game. I mean, what were the final numbers? Like 2 for 15 from three? I mean, my goodness. I mean, watching this thing, it was like a Plinko chip. The Price is Right, the way that ball was bouncing off that hoop. I couldn't believe it. And I said, we still have the lead. This is incredible. But, I mean, Elliott has been fantastic. Coach praised him. You know, he was looking for a pass first point guard. He was looking for a floor general, somebody who, you know, and thinking about that game, Elliott Cadow this season, very reminiscent of Chauncey Billups during the Pistons' run to an NBA title, right? That floor general, the pass-first guard who runs the offense. But, boy, when you needed a big shot, he came through in the clutch, and that was about as big a moment as you're going to get this season.
Well, on March 19th, 68 teams started the tournament, and one made it all the way through undefeated, your national champion, Michigan Wolverine. So congratulations to Dusty May and any of the people that were associated with the program. Really a tremendous effort. Let's switch gears a little bit. The Detroit Pistons, they clinched the number one conference seed in the East. This is the first time they've been in that position since the 2006-2007 season. And over the last 11 games, they haven't had Cade Cunningham. And I think we all took a collective deep breath when we heard about his collapsed lung. But they've been 8-3 since he has been out. And I think it shows the depth of the team. Anthony, what are you feeling like as we go into the playoffs, and how deep the team can make in terms of a run?
You know, in the 8-3, I mean, last night's game against Orlando, kind of a throwaway when you look at the fact that you don't have Tobias Harris. You know, you don't have Isaiah Stewart. He's been out since March 15th with the calf injury. The lineup's been all sorts of dinged up. You know, guys missing time. Duncan Robinson doesn't play. So they've had their fair share of injuries, but they've played through it. And this is another team where, you know, a lot of times I think we kind of overinflate a team's identity with the city, right? We want to conflate the two way too much. But this truly is a group that is very reminiscent of the going to work Pistons in the early 2000s and the Bad Boys of the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, this is exactly the style of team that this city loves. Talking about Michigan, how, you know, it's amazing what you can achieve when nobody cares who gets the credit. Same type of deal with the Pistons. I mean, this is a group. You look at the development of Jalen Duren, who, you know, I think should be the most improved player this year. I mean, the way that his game has elevated on the interior, I mean, he and Cade Cunningham are the best 1-2 lob threat in the league. The one thing that concerns me as we get towards the playoffs is our lack of shooting. And it's well documented. We just don't shoot the three-pointer very well. And that's going to be a little bit of a concern. I do worry about, you know, Cade, you know, getting back up to speed. It'll be a great jolt when he gets back into the lineup, because you're talking about an MVP caliber type of player. But I do, I do worry a little bit about our shooting when it comes down to playoff time. That much is for certain.
Well, we'll see what things shake out as the play-in tournament happens and how the rest of the playoff field unfolds. But it's been a great time for Michigan sports. And, Anthony, thank you for joining us. We've got Anthony Bellino, co-host of Sports Wrap with Lomas Brown and Anthony Bellino. Weeknights at 6 o'clock on WJR.
Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate you.
Welcome back. We're happy to be broadcasting live from the Sonic Temple this afternoon at our Detroit Economic Club event. Our next guest this afternoon is Michael Narlock, the head of astronomy at the Cranbrook Institute. Michael, welcome. Glad you are able to join us. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
So a lot of historical things happening that are probably very interesting to your area of expertise. We've got the Artemis II astronauts that have emerged from behind the moon and are heading towards home. Maybe just talk about, from a historical significance, what this means.
Well, it's certainly a unique time to be alive. We're going back to the moon, which human beings have not been on the moon since 1972. And we're doing it in at a pretty rapid rate. Some of your listeners may recall back when we were doing the Apollo missions and the Gemini missions and the Mercury missions, it took about a decade to go from we want to go to the moon to actually being able to go there. And while these plans have been underway for some time, they sort of sneak up on you. You know, April 1st, we launched what would be the equivalent of Apollo 8. It's basically a dry run of the mission to land people on the moon. And by all reckoning, Artemis II is doing well. It's supposed to splash down in the early evening on April 10th. And this is the next step to going to the moon. There'll be another mission probably next year. And then hopefully in 2028, we'll actually have boots on the ground on the moon once again.
For somebody who is an expert in this field, Michael, has it been surprising to you that it's been 50 plus years, or did you anticipate what we're seeing in terms of the timeline?
It's probably one of the more disappointing timelines because, you know, it became commonplace, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, that we were going to the moon. It was, you know, I'm sure everyone's familiar with the Apollo 13 catastrophe that sort of brought it back into the limelight. But then our priorities shifted. You know, it went from going to the moon to doing things in low Earth orbit. We had the space station, several different iterations of the space station. We currently have the ISS up there. The space shuttle, of course, dominated our space program for years and years and years. But the idea of going to the moon, and I think NASA has as much said that the idea here is that we are going to eventually not just go to the moon, but have a permanent presence on the moon. And that presents a whole lot of opportunity to explore the rest of the solar system. And I don't mean like sending robots out, which we have shown to do a wonderful job sending these robotic emissaries out to the other planets of our solar system, but maybe even sending now people to Mars would be the next logical step. So the movie The Martian may be more reality in our lifetimes than we had hoped.
You know, it's interesting how closely knit this world is from the standpoint of the Artemis crew and even Apollo. What resonated with me was the wake-up message that the Apollo 13 commander, Jim Lovell, recorded just a couple months before his death. And I think the message was along the lines of, welcome to my old neighborhood. It's a historic day. I know you're going to be busy, but don't forget to enjoy the view. That just spoke volumes, I think, of just how much there's this mutual respect for not only the history, but where we are currently. Your thoughts?
You know, I read about the Jim Lovell announcement today, as a matter of fact, and it did strike a chord because, yeah, he's no longer with us. I believe he was on Apollo 8. And this is what's mirroring, this Artemis 2 mirrors what Apollo 8's intended purpose was. But these types of things, as a species doing something, and yes, it's three Americans and a Canadian, but it's really an accomplishment of humankind to go to our moon. And yeah, there was a lot of the impetus to do it in 2028 probably has to do with the fact that there's good evidence to suggest that the Chinese want to land their version of astronauts by the year 2030. But the moon is for all of us. It's not to be claimed by one nation and have its resources and its use be dominated. So I like to think of this as another accomplishment for humanity, being able to go. And just imagine in the not too distant future, we may have the first example of a human being not born on the Earth, but maybe born on the moon. Those are the things of science fiction novels, you know, which are great reads, but you don't actually ever really anticipate that in your lifetime, you're going to be experiencing something like that. And I think that's really the message of coming together. And hopefully this is something much like the Apollo missions that went to the moon, sort of brought us together as a world, at least temporarily. Maybe that Artemis is going to do the same thing for us today.
I understand that after the Artemis surpassed Apollo's distance record, they found two new lunar craters, and they observed them. They asked for permission to name them. They named one Integrity, which is the name of the capsule that they're traveling in. And in a real classy move, one was named Carol, which was in honor of the commander, Reed Wiseman's wife, who passed away of cancer in 2020. So just some classy things that crew did to just take not only what their observations were, but make them long lasting with some of those efforts.
Yeah. And those four individuals are seeing something that very few human beings have seen, and that's the far side of the moon. And there were reports that they were seeing live impacts. One, I think, astronaut described it as looking a little bit like sparks these impacts on the far side of the moon, which is far more heavily cratered than the near side, the one that we're all used to seeing. It's, you know, I cannot imagine what it's like to be those four individuals to be on this journey. But I also think to myself how frustrating it might be to get so tantalizingly close to the moon. You know, they came within 4,000 miles of it, but not to be able to land, not to be somebody who puts their footprint on the lunar surface. That regardless of what they say, as a human being, you would think that would be just a little bit frustrating to get so close, but not be part of the crew that gets to actually land.
Probably doesn't feel too good to lose transmission for 45 minutes or so either. But
oh yeah, it's that's alone.
There's exciting times ahead, and what can happen over the next couple of years is, as Michael conveyed, I think it's going to be really something for all of us to watch for. A very historic time for not only us but the entire world. Michael Narlock, Cranbrook's Institute's head of astronomy. Thank you for dialing in today and talking with us on a really interesting topic. Michael, have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be with you for the second hour of the Focus Show with Paul W. Smith today. I'm very pleased to be joined by Marty Dobek. Marty is the executive director at the Detroit Sports Commission. Marty, it's good to have you on.
Thanks, Ryan. Great to be on with you this afternoon.
So about a year ago, we met, Marty. It was in this forum. I was co-hosting, I believe, with Steve Courtney, and you were coming on board to give some highlights of the things that are happening with the Detroit Sports Commission. So it's been a fast year. I've quickly gained a lot of respect for you, what you're accomplishing, and the contributions you're making to our sports community.
Yeah, time is flying right now, and the momentum continues to build, and it's just the nod to the collective effort of all the stakeholders, you know, with the Detroit Sports Commission, our board of advisors, which you sit on, and the corporate, the civic, philanthropic community. Everybody is really clicking right now, and you need that teamwork. And that teamwork was on display yesterday with the University of Michigan Wolverines winning the national championship. And we're so honored to be have the ball passed to us now here in Detroit to host the 2027 NCAA Men's Final Four April 2nd through the 5th, which is just going to be a great experience and a great opportunity for Detroit. And it's just not hosting an event. We're hosting the sports world. And, you know, the Final Four is a global event, and the goal is going to make it feel uniquely Detroit from the second people arrive. And we've proven we can do it at the highest level, like we did with the NFL draft, and now we get to raise the bar again.
Talk about the collaboration that happens. So we're obviously now officially on the clock, but you've learned a lot. You've spent time with the host city that just held the Final Four, Indianapolis. Talk about how that all works together, what you learned from them, and how that positions us for a greater level of success.
Yeah, we participated in a mandatory operational trip for the local organizing committee, and we were down in Indy, you know, starting last Wednesday. And Indy, they were incredible hosts. We took away many key learnings on public safety, the event itself, venue operations, the visitor hospitality, and much more. And we had roundtable meetings with the NCAA just yesterday and the Indy Sports Corp leaders, and really the goal was to make Detroit ready for the 2027 NCAA Men's Final Four and the fan experiences that come along with it, and really just make it unique to Detroit. And, you know, really for us here locally, it's going to take everybody, you know, with the Sports Commission, with Visit Detroit, Ford Field and Detroit Lions, the City of Detroit, State of Michigan, Michigan State University, who's our host institution. Just so many individuals and so many stakeholders that are going to be involved to come together to host a global sporting event like the Final Four.
And a lot of people, Marty, get focused on there's 2 days of games, April 3rd next year and the championship game on April the 5th. But there's so much more to the Final Four experience than just the two games. So talk about some of that engagement and how people can participate. Some will be at the game, some won't. But talk about the broad nature of how this will all come together.
Yeah, first and foremost, go to Final4Detroit.com. That's going to have all the information from now until the ball is tipped here in Detroit. And for a lot of people, the Final Four, it's about everything around the games, not just the games themselves. There's a fan fest. There's music incorporated. There's youth events. There's many community activations. It's really a full week of activities. And we want families, kids, people who may never go to a Final Four game to still feel like they're a part of it. And, you know, from the state and the city, it's their event, and we want them to feel like it is their event taking place in their city and their state. And there will be things happening morning to night, and it won't just be a couple hours of basketball and the games that you'll see on TV. There's going to be many citywide activations. And, you know, if you look at Detroit too, it's our footprint is so compact, very similar to Indy. And, you know, it's going to create a great flow across the city and something we're really excited about, because downtown Detroit is built for that kind of experience. And, you know, we're not just starting from scratch. We're taking best practices from the past host cities, including Indy, and building on them in a way that fits for Detroit.
Marty, you touched on something that I want you to, you know, share a little bit more about. And Detroit's the host city. The events will be at Ford Field, but you mentioned the state of Michigan, and there's things that are going to be happening outside of just core Detroit. Some of that is known and some will be forthcoming, but just give a little more insight about how important this is, not just to Detroit, but how we're engaging throughout Michigan in its entirety.
Yeah, there's going to be more information to come later this week, but all of it is exciting fan events that will take place around the state of Michigan. Our goal is to develop a you know, mobile experience that is spread across the state of Michigan and, you know, reaches all the way up to the Upper Peninsula to, you know, the southwest corner of our state, where folks can come out and learn about the Final Four that is coming to Detroit and experience some cool activations that are associated with it. There's going to be some information coming out soon on how people can mark their calendars for that type of experience. But the intentionality is for us is paramount of ensuring that when we're hosting an event in Detroit or our region, that, you know, the state of Michigan feels a part of it as well. And everybody from, like I mentioned, up in the Upper Peninsula to the southwest corner, northwest corners of the state, understand that, you know, it's just equally as part of, you know, their event as it is for those that live in Southeast Michigan.
Well, we had Anthony Bellino on earlier, co-host of Sports Wrap, and we talked about the Wolverines Championship, and I think it comes at a terrific time as a launch point for the 27 Final Four. The coach even made some mention during his remarks at the end of the game of Detroit, here we come. So I think all eyes are going to be on Detroit. We've proven that we can handle these big scale events and do it in a terrific way. The NFL draft was a perfect example of that. So we're looking forward to the success. Marty, thanks for your leadership on the Detroit Sports Commission. Very pleased today to have Executive Director Marty Doback talking about the 2027 Final Four in Detroit next year. Marty, thank you for joining.
Thank you, Ryan. Really appreciate it. Truly, you're the best. And thanks for all your support.
Take care. Bye-bye. We're glad to be back. We have as our next guest, Lieutenant Mike Shaw of the Michigan State Police. Lieutenant Shaw, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you join us. So April is an important month around driving safety. The focus is to reduce or eliminate distracted driving. Tell us about the initiative and some of the things that the collaboration of the police forces are doing to try to make an impact.
So yes, April is a distracted driving prevention month. So part of it is a campaign to educate drivers about distracted driving. You don't have to be a police officer to drive around the state of Michigan and see the amount of people that still have a phone in their hand, even though that we've had a hands-free law here in Michigan since 23. So we really want to kind of focus on that and how important it is to focus on the roadways. Naturally, not everyone is going to go along with just the education portion of it. So we also have to have some way to take a little bit of money out of your wallet to get your attention. And that's through an enforcement campaign that we're running. We started it off April 1st with our Lake to Lake enforcement campaign. And that was along the I-94 corridor. And also for the first time went up into Canada and into Indiana. So we started off just kind of reminding people there. And then ourselves, troopers, deputies, and local officers will be looking for those distracted drivers with some extra patrols all month long.
Well, it's unfortunate, but we're still seeing an increasing usage of mobile devices, despite that 2023 state law that is allowing the police to write tickets for any cell phone use. Anything behind the wheel, voice activated is okay, but you know, what do you attribute the increasing level of usage when we're trying to get the opposite outcome?
You know, I think it's hard. I think we're pretty addicted to our phones, and sometimes we can't fight ourselves when we hear that ding or if something there. We just can't prevent ourselves from trying to grab it to look over and see what that message is, or, you know, why your phone, what the email is or something like that. But we also see, you know, some people that do a lot of other things out on patrol. I've seen people try to put cream cheese on a bagel between their knees. I've seen people actually Velcro an iPad to their steering wheel so they can watch Netflix. So we really want to concentrate on letting people know that any tiny distraction behind the wheel can add to our traffic fatalities. So we see that, you know, 65 people in 2024 lost their lives in distracted driving fatalities. But since you're at an economic summit as well, it does affect that as well, because, you know, as we have these large traffic crashes and we close roadways down, that means your DoorDash driver's a little distracted and can't get to where they're supposed to be going, your Amazon driver. And then commerce, you know, on those freeways, because due to distracted driving, we're almost forced to close entire freeways to investigate traffic crashes because we see our troopers getting hit on the side of the road by distracted drivers. So it kind of adds to a lot of stuff that a lot of people don't consider. But we really want people to start, you know, taking distracted driving seriously, just as seriously as we take any type of distraction or driving, risky driving behavior, from impaired driving to speeding to following too closely. Distracted driving is something that really affects you as well.
Do you find any certain age group, demographic, anything that is more likely to be doing this than other cross sections of the population?
So there's not a lot of focus. It kind of hits everybody. I know some people joke around a little bit that us older folks, and I'm not saying you, I'm saying me, we may not be a fast texter. So it may concentrate as well, but there's also our younger drivers that have basically grown up with electronic devices in their hand almost from the womb. So they have a particular hard time of kind of getting away from that device. So we see that quite a bit with our younger drivers as well.
Well, it's an excellent campaign you're launching over the course of the month of April. The intent is to create a safer environment for people to travel. All you all want to happen is people get to and from their destinations safely and not have a negative outcome for somebody's family. And you talked about all those, you know, fatalities. Those are important people to individuals out there that, quite honestly, some of this could be prevented. We've got a ton of traffic out on the roadways. People need to be fully engaged and paying close attention to what they're doing. And the goal is one that, you know, we're certainly aligned with you on, Lieutenant. And I thank you for your leadership and the things that you're doing to try to make the Michigan roads safer.
Thank you. We really do appreciate that. We just want people to realize that driving is a tough job, and you got to get behind the wheel, and you can't look at breakfast or you can't look at your phone. You need to concentrate. One of the things that we always say is to get your head out of your app, so to speak, and, you know, really pay attention to what you're doing out there. You know, put your eyes on the road and not on your phone.
I was worried they were going to have to censor that for a minute there, Lieutenant. But we've got Lieutenant.
I was worried with the campaign started as well, if there was going to be an error on my part. And so far, I've been okay. So.
You're doing great. This is Lieutenant Mike Shaw, Michigan State Police. Thank you for being part of our show this afternoon.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
So, Mike, David, a lot of other things going on in Michigan.
Yeah, and the lieutenant kind of gave me a little heart attack, but he did a good job of selling that. Yeah, it's great talking to Anthony Bellino and Marty Dobeck about not only Michigan winning that national championship, but it coming here next year. And we were all hoping for a Michigan State final. But we can put that off a year to have it here in Detroit, don't you think?
I think that's fine. I mean, you know, we're in the crosshairs of everybody's interest now. You know, Michigan winning that first title in so many years, and you know, Michigan State doing well. I mean, it's a certain possibility that could happen.
I also saw something online. Somebody reminded social media that the last time Michigan won the national championship in basketball, the Bad Boy Pistons won the NBA championship. So we have Michigan winning the national championship. Pistons are number one seed. Maybe history repeats itself. I don't know.
That team's impressive. And, you know, as we talked to Anthony earlier, I mean, to be 8-3 without Cade and
right.
and having the depth that they've had and figure out, and they've beat some good teams over that 11 games. And
yeah.
hopefully they come back for the playoffs a little stronger and, you know, even more depth and they're ready to get after it. But I mean, they're an impressive group.
Well, and I think that, you know, they hung with Oklahoma City the other week. Oklahoma City wasn't resting anyone. SGA was in. And I think maybe what that does is maybe you don't need to rush Cade back for the first round. Maybe you can handle an eighth seed. So that might give them a little more time to collapse, to heal from the collapsed lung, which doesn't sound like something you get over in 2 weeks.
Well, in the Lakers game, I went to the game that they played them, and you know they came out on top there as well.
Right.
And so you know I think it's going to be a fun playoff run for them, and we'll see how it shakes out when they get all the seedings in place. But it's good to be a Detroit sports fan right now.
It really is. We have a lot to look forward to.
Well, we're glad to be back broadcasting live from the Masonic Temple this afternoon. Our next guest is Rania Cruz. She is the president and CEO of OpTech, which is a talent development and solutions firm that was launched in 1999. And Rania, thanks for coming back on the show. I saw that you had a very nice piece of recognition recently as you were inducted to the Michael Illich School of Business Entrepreneurship and Innovation Hall of Fame at Wayne State University. So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
We're happy to talk about a number of things with you this afternoon. So we just concluded Austin Goolsbee's presentation, and he'll be joining here in just a few minutes on the show. But what stood out to you, and what is it mean based on what you heard him talk about today for Michigan businesses?
Yeah. Thank you, Ryan, for having me today. He was incredibly interesting and really reinforced a lot of what we're feeling in the business community. What we're experiencing right now is, you know, there has been a slowdown in the number of hires, and a lot of companies are not necessarily letting people go. But what that tells us, especially being in a talent firm, is that, you know, companies are really uncertain about what's going to happen in the economy. And so they're reluctant to make those huge investments because of what we're experiencing with the war and oil prices and, you know, of course, the pullback with the EVs and tariffs. All these things impact the business community. And Yeah, and so what we're experiencing, of course, servicing our clients in many different industries, is they're afraid to start new projects. So they're just kind of holding off. And then, of course, we do a lot of work with young people, kids that are coming out of school, and the unemployment rate is quite high for those kids. They're really having a hard time finding jobs. And we see that in a big way because of the work I do with Digital Lakes. And so, but one of the pretty interesting facts, this is totally off in left field, is the dogs that are used for the feds are the same dogs that are used for the Lions. I thought that was pretty interesting.
He's always got some kind of an interesting comment or two. Talk a little bit about AI. You know, that's a hot topic out there. In fact, I was with a group of peer credit union CEOs last week, and we had three topics we talked about. The first one and the longest one was around AI, use cases. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? What does it not mean? How are you thinking about the impacts of AI in the workforce from the lens that you look at things through?
Yeah, of course. One of the interesting points that Austin made is that the job, or the lack of job growth, if you will, is not due to AI, which I think that was interesting because I see it in a different light. So right now, when we look at AI, it's no longer theoretical, it's operational. Many companies are leaning heavily into it for a number of different reasons. Obviously, all these companies are looking to cut costs, increase revenue, improve their workflows. And so it's no longer if you're going to lean into it, it's you have to lean into it. And we advise individuals that are getting into the market, and it's no longer an option to understand how to work alongside of AI. It is absolutely mandatory.
Well, and one of the things that we talked about in our gathering last week was really the difference in improving personal productivity as an employee, and where within your organization is it improving processes? Is it creating additional capacity? Is it repurposing people? Not necessarily just from the standpoint of how do we reduce, but how do we take the mundane? How do we take things that really don't create a lot of job satisfaction? How do we offload that so people can do more valuable types of tasks and contribute at a greater level, have a higher level of employee satisfaction?
Yeah, you know, what I often say is that AI is my superpower. And that's the way I look at it, and that's the way I advise my team and clients, is that leveraging AI for productivity it's incredible the amount of work you can get done if you understand how to work alongside of it. So what we're finding is that from an organizational standpoint, we provided training policies to make sure there's guardrails, but also to make sure that we're training up our people so that they are leveraging it and are not fearful of it, that it's going to replace their job, but using it to be more impactful, as you mentioned before, more productivity, because ultimately companies want to do more with less, right? Cost the productivity, they want to do a lot more and not have to pay as much money. And so by using AI, you're making your people more productive.
So you're leading OpTech, involved in the Digital Lakes, as you mentioned. What are some of the things that you're most focused on right now to support Michigan's workforce, which then should dovetail into economic growth?
Yeah. We are focused on providing the best talent to our clients and to help them with this digital transformation. And that includes data, making sure that they have the best people, because this all comes down to people, process, and technology. AI cannot be done on its own. You need people. You need strong people. And you need processes and technology. And then from a digital lake standpoint, we're looking at the workers of tomorrow. We're trying to create the best, most productive people for the jobs of tomorrow and connecting them with employers. And it's so important in our economy to really spend time to develop the talent pipeline. Right now, like I said, it's 11%, I believe there was quoted, unemployment for these people. We're trying to provide them opportunities so that they could be gainfully employed and contribute to our economy.
Some great thoughts from Rania Cruz, President and CEO of OpTech. I think we should have another visit and talk about this young person workforce challenge. These
yes.
college graduates that are coming out. We were talking about that not only at my CEO roundtable, but even internally about how do we create more opportunities for the people that are really going to set the stage for the future in these companies, and how do we get them engaged, feeling good. So we'd love to get some further input on that at some point. So, Rania, thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's always great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Well, it's great to be back to wrap up the show today. And Austin Goolsbee from the Chicago Fed, he's the president and chief executive officer, is joining us to wrap up the hour. And I was just speaking to Austin before during the break, and lots of great feedback on the presentation that you gave. We've had a number of different guests on that shared that your comments really resonated. So thank you for being with us.
Hey, Ryan, thank you for having me.
So for those that maybe aren't familiar with the Fed's role, can you talk a little bit about how maintaining maximum employment, stable prices, how does the role shift in those areas?
Well, there's a law, the Federal Reserve Act, and it says exactly what you hinted at. When the Federal Open Market Committee meets, which is every 6 weeks, to vote on what to do with interest rates, we're supposed to look at two things and two things only: stabilizing prices and maximizing employment. And they call that in our world the dual mandate. We have a dual mandate, and we have only one tool, and it's basically a screwdriver. You can tighten, you can loosen, and usually that approximately works, because if the economy is aiming toward recession and is cooling, by cutting the interest rate, you get more investment, you get more consumer spending on, they buy cars, et cetera. And if the economy is overheating and you're getting too much inflation, you kind of tighten it down a little bit by raising the interest rate. What is harder is kind of what we're facing now, where both sides are getting worse at the same time. Because then it's harder to figure out, well, what do you loosen to try to ease the struggles in the job market but at the risk that it makes the inflation go up, or do you tighten to try to get rid of the inflation but then it risks driving you into recession? So I'd say that's where everybody sits around the table. There's 19 people around the table, and it's a committee. And if you're an econ nerd, it's pretty neat. You know, you go in and they pull down the shades so nobody can spy on it. And we're going to go around the table and everybody give their worldview and what they think should happen. That said, it can be contentious because people are coming from a lot of different backgrounds and different views.
Does it vary the opinions based on the geographic area? Because, you know, data's data.
Yeah,
but that subjectivity is...
Yeah, nicely said. There's a little subjectivity that 12 of the 19 people are from a distinct region. And the Chicago Fed, Illinois and Michigan, Wisconsin and Indiana, and Iowa. That's kind of my 7th district, heart of the Midwest. I'll spend a lot of the time in between meetings out talking to business people. We're here in Michigan. We're talking to a bunch of Detroit folks. Tomorrow we'll head out to Kalamazoo and talk to some manufacturers there. I come with a different sensibility than maybe some others do, and likewise for their regions. So I don't know. I'll give that a 1/3 weight. Mm-hmm. You know, that's 1/3 of the differences around the table.
So talk a little bit about the Middle East, the current situation we find ourselves in, the rising oil prices. What's your take on the current economic conditions? What do people need to be either focused on or possibly aware of and more conservative in their planning?
Well, look, as I say, there's some problems facing the economy that are subtle and require a little study to figure out why is this bad or where is this going. There are other problems that aren't subtle at all, and this one is not subtle. you just drive in your car, you look out the window at what the prices are at a gas station, and you have a very good idea of what the risk is to the U.S. economy from an extended geopolitical environment like this. It's that the prices are going to go up. Now, the U.S. economy compared with, say, the 1970s, the U.S. economy is less energy intensive and more of a energy producer than it was back then. So there are at least some things going the other way. If the price of oil goes up and stays up for a while, you would think that there's going to be at least some investment and some expansion coming from energy production. But that said, you know what's going to go wrong is that consumers are going to get pinched and consumer spending is either going to fall or it's going to grow slower. And I'll just emphasize the last 2 years, the main engine of growth in this country was not data centers, it's not AI, all of that stuff, yeah, it's booming, but it's just the bread and butter American consumer spending, their income growing at a moderate pace, their spending growing at a moderate pace, and that's what's kept us cruising along. So if this conflict in the Middle East, and I'm not trying to make myself out like I'm a foreign policy expert, I'm not. We want, and my hope is that this not be a long-lasting thing. That if this is temporary, if you ask what will be the macroeconomic impact of a conflict that goes for 3 months and then goes back to where it was before, the answer, lasting impact, would be close to nothing. If you say what would be the impact of oil prices going to $140 a barrel for the next year and a half, now we got to have a deeper discussion.
Talk a little bit about tariffs. You know, that's one of the things that, boy, there's so many different opinions about that. It crosses over into the political component. But, you know, moving aside from that, just from an economic perspective, help us kind of understand the policies that are out there from a tariff perspective, who they benefit, who they hurt.
Well, it depends how you do them. I was an economist before. I've been at the Fed for a little over 3 years. Before that, I was 30 years a research economist at the University of Chicago. Economists are not big fans of tariffs because tariffs raise prices. And that's especially true if you're going to apply the tariffs to parts, components, supplies, not just the final goods that are coming from somewhere else. Now, all of that said, imported goods are only 11% of GDP in the United States. So what I said all along is if tariffs stay in their lane, there is a sense in which the affected industries will notice, but the macro economy, they don't have to be a material thing to the overall economy if they stay in their lane. Now, how do they get out of their lane? If there's retaliation, they would get out of their lane. If you apply them to parts and components, now you just turned a tariff into a tax on domestic production, and that's where it starts getting into my world in the Fed, that I'm coming around here in Michigan talking to the oil companies and talking to the auto companies, and they're expressing at Liberation Day time real fear that this is going to drive up their costs. Now, all of that said, state of Michigan was the number one most exposed to tariff state in the nation. We got a soundtrack going.
Yeah. Austin, it's so great to have you on the show. Thank you for coming to Detroit Economic Club event. We're very pleased to have the President Chief Executive Officer of the Chicago Fed with us. Thank you for your insights
Anytime.
And being part of
it's lovely. And you got good music.